Hi, this is Stephen Downs, and we're located in the ballroom at the Delta Hotel in Winnipeg for the CADE Amtech conference. I'm just about to give my talk, The Meaning is the Message, and there's someone just going up to the stage to introduce me now, so here we go. I decided to go with a paper titled The Meaning is the Message, going with the McLuhan theme, and it seemed like a good idea at the time. But there are some elements in McLuhan that are similar to the sorts of things that I think are the case in that sense. I'm probably McLuhanian. Not everything, but the hot and cold media doesn't really speak to me, and so on. But The Meaning is the Message does speak to me. The green one. And if I had to summarize, it's also very weird, it's a big, huge screen. I've been expecting all the banners to drop and other to end of the film.
No special
effects. No special effects. Well, it's funny because, you know, I find that the medium is the message, the medium is the message. And it's not the message that I had in mind at all. what I want to say, because we have this idea that when we say something, when we have a sentence means something, and what that sentence means can be found in the words that that sentence consists of. And what I'm trying to say is that this is not the case, that the meaning of a piece of text, a piece of content, a presentation, a course, a game, whatever, isn't in the words, it isn't in the content that it presents. The medium itself is the meaning. So, and I think this is following very much from what McLuhan is saying. We have this picture here, this came from Boston. how they tell. And it doesn't really matter who's in that picture, does it? If, even if I had a caption underneath identifying all the people, the meaning is in the presentation of the media itself as a whole. The idea of the traditional representation is that media stands for something. It mediates. It's in between yourself and the thing out there in the world. Media consists of a sign, some sort of representation, a word, a symbol, a picture, and then something out there in the world that is signified or represented by the medium. But the big question is, what is represented? Well, traditionally we think that what is represented is whatever is pointed to or referred to by the word. So we use the word training in a sense. It's like the word is pointing to a thing out there in the world, a train. And that's where we get our meaning of the word train. So if we use the word train, we look at actual trains and say, oh yeah, okay, that's what we mean by train. But the problem is we can use words in combination that do not actually stand in a referential relation to anything. For example, and this is old Russell Strawson stuff in the early part of the 1900s, brakeless trains are dangerous. Where do we get the meaning of a sentence like brakeless trains are dangerous? And the very fact that brakeless trains are dangerous means that there are none, because you wouldn't want to make a brakeless train because it would be dangerous. So if the sentence brakeless trains are dangerous is true, by virtue of what is true? Because there's nothing out there in the world that it can point to. Sentences like this, counterfactual sentences, therefore can't get their meaning from the state of affairs in the world. Russell Strawson, the days, he went through a whole bunch of different examples. The present king of France is bald. Is that true or false? Kind of a hard question to answer, isn't it? But where's the meaning of that coming from? How do we know what that sentence means? And yet, manifestly, we do. So, rather than simple reference to establish the meaning of something, the traditional picture still says that we go through some sort of process of inference. And this is a phrase that I'm sure you're all pretty familiar with, like signal and noise, getting the signal from the noise. We run through some sort of process. We have some sort of signal that comes to us, and we run through in our head and extract the meaning from that, based on some sort of representation or model of the world. This is your typical SIFT model, where you have a sensation, and then you do some sort of inference. Your inference is some sort of logical operation that you're doing in relation to a model of the world. Also your goals, your ambitions, your memory, etc. That model is created or built out of deep. Don't do that. Go to the speakers. That's sort of almost like your translation. Some sort of deep thinking where you build or construct the meaning that will constitute your model. And that's how we assign meaning to our perceptions. The problem is, I personally don't think anyone does that. Because when you listen to a sentence, if you listen to the sentence that I'm uttering right now, you can ask yourself, are you running through some sort of process of inference? You might be scratching your head, and that's okay. I guess according to Kirchhoff, I shouldn't be understanding this talk anyways, which is probably true. But are you running through some sort of inference? Are you comparing the words that I'm using to some sort of mental model? And I don't think that that's what's happening. Look at a sentence like this. I saw a cat in Madrid. And we all understand that sentence, right? I think we do. But there are two types of people in the world. They're well. No, there are two types of people in the world. One type of people,
the type of I am,
like cats. They think cats are great. They think they're wonderful. Cats are the best animals in the world. I have four of them. I think that's not enough. I can only afford to feed four. cats are great. So I say something like, I see a cat in Madrid, or I saw a cat in Madrid, that's a good thing. There's the other people. I won't call them dog people. But they're people that are typified by a remark that I heard once, that a cat is a house rat. They hate cats. They think cats are dirty and disgusting and anyone, you know. Now, if a person like that said, I saw a cat in Madrid, they're saying something very different. So the meaning of this sentence isn't just going to be the words, it isn't just going to be what the words actually mean in a model of the world. The meaning of the sentence is going to depend very much on who's speaking it, where they're speaking, whether or not they like cats. And Clone said, content is a juicy piece of meat. Our communications, any given communication, consists of the sentence. You know, when I actually created this slide, I had never had any idea that it would be that big. But if you have the actual sentence and the medium that it's delivered in, but also the environment in which it's being delivered and the person who's doing the delivering. What I want to say, now we're getting into the more experimental part of this talk, but what I want to say, drawing from when McLuhan says the content of one medium is another medium, and the example he uses is the content of a movie is the novel, and the content of the novel is the experience. So what I want to say is, following from that, that if the content of one medium is another medium, in the end, the user, the person doing the uttering, is the content of the medium. The representation, the model that we have representing the world, if we think that we derive the meaning of the sentence, is not the source of truth. Rather, you are. Now, the traditional model, our words stand in relation to things in the world, and these things come into us and help us form mental representations. Reality, truth, perceptions, these are all things that have an independent existence in the world. But in fact, what I want to say is happening is that through our media, we are projecting ourselves out to the world, so that we don't work in terms of reality, truth, perception, but rather we work in terms of the type of media that we are projecting out into the world. How's this going so far? Is nobody saying anything in the comments?
We're still learning
from
that cat talking.
Alright, I'll keep going. I'll keep going until someone stops me. So.
That next slide, but doesn't that still happen? Reality comes into us, but the difference is we now have more opportunities to push back out.
Well, this is just it. Actually, I can move to the next slide here. What we call reality is no more or less real than the representations of the communication. They're both. Both of these things are pushing out. When we talked about, you know, the real world, truth, or, you know, I've put in justice and morality, you know, these things that we think the world is, they are as much a communication coming out of ourselves as our actual communications.
But those are abstracts, not something that's concrete.
They are abstract. But when you press somebody, when you ask them, where does reality come from? Or, well, maybe justice and morality are less obvious examples, but reality, where does that come from? They want to say it comes from outside the person and sort of flows through the person and then out into the world. But then the stuff that was out there flowing through the person. That's the content of the communication. But what I'm trying to say here is that what we think is out there is as much a product of our thinking as the very obvious products of our thinking, which are our communications.
And then how, isn't that just kind of posing the challenge that Plato answered when he said there has to be some reality out there, if it is only a cat or a dog, because there has to be something that we perceive. And so what we think is reality is that you know, ideal out there that we perceive. Maybe there has to be something out there, or else we can't see it or we can't make it.
This nice lady opens the inner worms of this classical philosophy. All right. This is sounding a lot to me like existentialism. If it's existentialism, fine. What do we do about David Hume's game of billiards whenever he was confronted by the dilemma of what is reality, what is real? Am I projecting reality to myself? He said, I always go and play billiards. Sure. And of course, the point is that it's a mathematical construct about which we all seem to be able to agree.
Well, but that's...
And for me, that's the basis of training, so there is a degree of communication in teaching. Still.
All right.
Though I take your point about context, and I take your point about...
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. Give me context. There was a comment here. Yes. If you're Plato, they're in the singular. If you're postmodern, you're in the plural. Let's come back. I don't know what that was. My position is more the Humean position than the existentialist. And I'm glad you raised that. Hume plays billiards. Yes, Hume plays billiards. And he uses the cue, he strikes the ball, this ball strikes another ball, the other ball hopefully goes into the pocket. What is that? Well, people say that's cause and effect. One ball hits the other ball. But what Hume wants to say is that the attribution of cause and effect to this scenario in front of me is a habit of the mind. It's something that I create. It's not something that's in the world. So, and that's why I should have put causation in that box on the left as well. So what we think the world is much of a projection of our thoughts as actual communication. And the reason why I want to say that is because we typically hold truth or meaning of our sentences to be grounded in these statements of the world. But these statements of the world are no more certainly true, no more certainly real, than our actual communications. Go ahead.
All right. I just have a little problem with making the same comparison. It seems to me that we could be talking about thinking or you could be talking about offering, but I'm not sure if this communicates because that does involve the speaker. And so there's the whole dilemma of what is actually ending up at the other end really means is the meaning. So that's the part I'm and to go back to your cat analogy, which is context, it's also inflection, is how we give the meaning. So if I say, I saw a cat in Madrid, that's great. It's supposed to be, I saw a cat in Madrid. If I give meaning to it by inflection, as well as maybe what you know about me as a human or a cat, but we both agree there's the reality of what a cat is, and we both agree there was a cat, that both of us would have seen it. And then it was our personal reaction to it that was very different because we had that larger context. But we communicated because we agreed on what a cat is and how we know.
Well, what is a cat? I ask that in all seriousness because it's a picture of a cat, this paper mache cat, is an elaborately constructed robot cat. Would it still be a cat if it was dead? We think we have these understandings in common. This form of voice, I saw a cat in Madrid. Well, if I say that to some certain person, who interprets tones of voice differently, they might think that I was really happy to have seen it. I get in trouble with my wife, who's from California, and every once in a while I say something, she looks at me and says, "That was a tone." And I'm here, "No tone." We have, and I'll come to this, we have these abstractions. We think these abstractions are the things that we have in common, but when we push these abstractions even slightly, we fall apart. Let me forge ahead. Because there are two types of people in the world. I was talking about this last week at the Second Life conference that they just sort of put on. And Second Life, of course, is this online thing. And I talked about the history of the internet. The history of the internet, there are two types of people in the history of the internet. The text people who use email and use Net and all of these text kind of things. And then the games people who play games, the games first. And so with Second Life coming to the fore, things like YouTube and Flickr and all of that, we're seeing that division between text people and now I'm calling them speech people. And the thing is, the media that these people use to communicate, these media themselves actually say different things. Look at what somebody who writes in text, who presents text, look at what they have. They have language, they have grammar, they have syntax, they have this world of universal truth. They have this concept. Cats and bodies, different types of animals, all of that. The way I'll explain that is to say, that's how I'm going to explain that. That's a good question. because I'm not trying to explain derivative in the presentation, which is okay. But what I want to do is say that what I'm representing here are ways in which the world is represented through different kinds of media. And even within the scope of the main discourse that includes words, sentences, paragraphs, and all of that, there are different ways of interpreting how that media represents the world. For example, even you can say text in English represents the world in one way, text in French represents the world in another way. I'm trying to draw out here some aspects of text based communication in general, which I'm not going to make some shortcuts here, but which I'm identifying as things like universals and truth. The nature of the universal might be that it always assumes its opposite, or it might not be that. I can be silent on that and still make the point that when people use text to communicate, they are using these absolutes, they are using these abstractions, these universals. How's that? No,
you have to have a
child. Okay, that's good. Like I say, a lot of this I'm kind of pushing my own envelope as well. But that's okay. Well, if it isn't, too late. I'm trying to contrast the text people with what I'm calling here the speech people. It's what I was calling the game people at the other talk. Where instead of language, grammar, syntax, things like sound, accent, and tone coming to the fore. Which now, the question, your comment about tone suddenly bothers me. What would you like to say?
Almost is true. I think you have a problem because language is true, grammar is fluid, and syntax is fluid, as far as I'm concerned. If I'm a text person, I can really admit it. But I'm looking at sound, accent, and tone. And the moment you have some kind of consensus between more than one or two people about what a sound like means.
Oh, thank you.
Well, I'm just trying to choose a dramatic example. there's a quality of a Greek, I mean, and it's only an absolute pinball, because we're still in an existential world when we do project. And I might be a person who is actually quite harmless, and I just chose to make that enormous noise to make a point. But those of you who were frightened, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to. But did you see what I'm going on? I don't think there's a real distinction there. I really can't see a real distinction on this. Everything is relative. There's relativity in everything, but speech people are relative in their way, and text people should be relative in their way. If you've got a text person who says, language is, there is proper English and there is nothing but proper English in it, so helping God in any kind of context, yeah, they're
But there are things that are in language that aren't in the non-language thing. There's nothing in the non-language thing that corresponds, for example, to the triangle, which is an absolute form. There's nothing that corresponds to the universal state, all the life patterns and animals.
Well, you said a world of sensations and similarity, the triangle. It's a perception of three sides. I would have thought that was somewhere in that world. An isosceles triangle is three sides. That's similarity. Wouldn't it fit there?
No, because. I'm actually liking this, at least some people are, but that's okay. There's the perception that we have, and then there's an interpretation that we place on it, which is the triangle. And what you're doing here is you're saying that the perception of the triangle and the description of the perception as a triangle are one and the same thing. You're imposing this universal form, triangle, on the perception. But that's no more, or it's no different than imposing the description of cause and effect on the movement of linear cause. It's something that you're bringing to this this perception. For example, a triangle necessarily has three sides. Does your perception necessarily have three sides? It's not so
clear. Well, my perception of a triangle necessarily has three sides. If we're going to use the term triangle,
if we're
just going to say there's a shape out there, does it necessarily have three sides? No.
There is no necessity in your perception, but there is necessity in the concept of a triangle.
Yeah, which is a way of communicating my perception to another person.
So your perception is not the same as the triangle that you're using to describe it. See the difference? And it's a natural thing for us to think that we'll always see a triangle. Oh yeah, no, I see the triangle. But there isn't in the perception that there is in the concept. That's interesting, because I would say that the person who comes up with triangles is the person who's multiplying the entities. I'll change the example of this a little slightly. Think of tigers. Think of what you know about tigers. When you think about a tiger, are you thinking of some sort of idealized tiger, a thing that now, are you thinking of the words I'm looking for here? The thing that is necessarily struggling for words, the abstract concept of Tadir, as opposed to, for example, a representative Tadir, I don't even want to say it like that, but an image of a Tadir that we've actually seen. Yeah. And most people, when they think of a Tadir, they think of some actual Tadir, as opposed to some abstract Tadir. So now, when we come up with something like the abstract Tadir, that's the creation of extra entities. Our thinking about tigers isn't based on the model of tigers. It isn't based on the abstract tiger. It's based on the tigers that we've actually seen, that we've actually experienced. And when we encounter something new, when we go into the jungle and something comes out at us, we think about that according to how similar it is to something we've already seen, as opposed to whether it fits into this model, or whether it fits into this model or this abstract description. Okay, so well there. It lasted for a lifetime. Now, that slide doesn't even follow anymore from the discussion we had, but that's what I'm trying to say here is that the message that the newscaster presents to people is not simply in the words that this person is speaking, it's not simply the concept that this person is expressing, but rather it's the whole picture. If I could subtitle this, because this is a caption, I'd do a caption something like the middle class news reporter, where we're presented a picture on the television of something, an account of what's normal. What's normal is everybody has an RSP. What's normal is everyone has a house. What's normal is lower taxes is relief rather than, say, funding for programs. What I'm trying to say with this discussion is that what we teach when we teach isn't the content, but actually what we model, what we demonstrate. And hopefully I'm not mad. The reason why I'm trying to take this line is we spend a lot of time and a lot of effort thinking about what the content of our lesson is going to be. What the objective or what the objectives are, for example. And yet, what is learned is not so much the content that's presented in the book or in the lesson, but rather the entire presentation of the material. Even think about this session. What are you learning in this session? Or if anything, are you getting the content, or is the entire mode of presentation forming part of your impressions of this particular session? For me, it certainly is. I wasn't expecting this sort of setup, but the media of text, the media of grammar and syntax, the media that we talked about is having things like truth and reality, causality. That's the abstract media. That's the media that is based on a model or a representation of the world, as compared to the new media, which is not rooted or grounded in abstract or universal, but rather in senses and perceptions, the acoustic, the tactile, the sight. And so we have different metrics, different properties of this media, similarities, connections, links. The old media is text. The new media is visual. The old media, and this was in Derek's talk earlier, is hierarchical. And this could easily be an organization. It could be the structure of a book, or it could be the structure of a sentence. The new media is more of a network. There is nothing at the top, there is nothing at the bottom, there isn't a center, per se. idea there isn't a single source of truth, there isn't a single source of reality. Rather, as Wittgenstein says, knowledge has many authors, it has many facets. It looks different. It's like the way the cat looks different to each person in Madrid. Each bit of knowledge looks different to each person that transmits it, that receives it. There isn't the commonality. When you say something, there isn't the commonality that I hear the same thing that you think that you're saying. Because what you're saying, you're projecting yourself. What I'm hearing myself. Sorry about that. Somewhere along the line, and this is the reaction, the pushback, I think, that I'm getting here. We've adopted the presumption that the abstract is real, that causality is more real than our discussions of causality or even our skepticism about causality, that the triangle is more real than our perception of the triangle. And this is reflected in the way we teach, in the manner in which we present to learn materials. We teach sameness. We teach everybody the same curricula in a class, for example, or a grade. Readings, essay questions. We test for sameness. We try to make sure that everybody passes their minimum standards. But learning isn't about sameness. Learning isn't about getting that fact of the world from the model. Learning is rather being able to recognize, I don't want to say, you know, I don't even like saying patterns, because you know, it comes back to some of the discussion back there. Even to say patterns, we're talking about more abstract things. But it's learning to recognize the tiger that you once saw before. It's identifying similarities in your experience.
Isn't that what you just said? That we shouldn't be doing looking for sameness?
No, because there's a difference between sameness and similarity. The sameness means that two entities have, I don't want to say the same part, but we tend to be circular definition. But you know what I mean? But sameness presupposes an identity between two things. But similarity allows for there to be a difference. If two things are the same, all of their properties must be the same. But if two things are similar, there can be a difference. Similarity is similar. When we reason through metaphor, for example, we're reasoning through similarity rather than through metaphor. That allows us to make inferences about things that aren't the same as things that we've seen before. And pardon? Well, right. It is possible, but then you've got some.
Because all we've been testing the similarities. At least in literature,
well,
no two students, if 10 students are exactly the same as they were before, you want to get the question.
If we're testing for similarity, not sameness, then why do we have exactly the same curriculum for every student in class? It's on a piece of paper.
Individualized. Those kinds of things that we have been doing. They've been around.
Oh, I realize that. But there are aspects of even of these individualized learning plans that are identical.
Not similar, they are the same. There are aspects that are the same.
learning outcome. Surely a good learning outcome really addresses only the things that you expect to see that are similar to students to say that they achieve the outcome. You don't say they all have to be exactly that. That's not what that's all learning outcomes do. They are phrased in a general way. That's all.
So that's, I'll be honest with you, that's not my perception. And perhaps that's an effort that being made is to address similarity. But I don't see that as being the desired outcome. I see people, when they talk about now, like, say, passing grade 5, they have a very precise idea of what they want these students to accomplish. They want every student in that class to be able to do math graduation. They want every student in that class to be able to run that program or whatever. They're given a math test, and they're expected to have the same answer that we mark. There are cases. Admittedly, there are cases where the curricula is adapted to individuals, but I'd say in many cases, that's not the case. This question of identity. Identity in sameness is tricky because and at a certain level of abstraction, everything is the same. And at a certain level of detail, everything is different. And so, I mean, there's always going to be exceptions to statements that are made about similarity and sameness. That's always going to be the case. And but that does not show that what I'm trying to show is false. What I'm trying to show is false, or what I'm trying to show is that an effort to achieve sameness of results, or the sameness of method, even, it is not believable. That's treating the abstract as real. That's treating the abstract as determinative of truth and reality. And so, in that sense, sure, I mean, at a certain point you can say, oh, but I'm not doing sameness. But at a certain point you are doing sameness. And I'm saying, where you are doing sameness, you should be thinking more about the inference. And where you are not doing sameness, that's good. Then you're doing sameness. Sameness is the real truth. The way we learn isn't based on sameness. The way we learn is based on similarity. It's based on pattern recognition. It's based on seeing part of something and inferring to the whole. It's based on the example I use, when we learn something, it's like when we find Waldo on the picture. Where's Waldo? And once you find Waldo on the picture, you can never unfind him. Sort of like your brain snaps into attention. And it, so it's just this recognition that, oh yes, there's Waldo. And that's very different from acquiring a fact. It's very different from acquiring some sort of content. Recognition is like seeing patterns in a mesh. And so this is the experience I'm trying to elicit here, the aha, the out of the blue experience, and I like talking to this. There's a sentence in my head, but it's just not there. Yes. Sure. Textual and image as opposed to textual text and textual speech, and that's probably a better division. What I was trying to do with that, obviously not as successfully as I would like, was trying to draw out the difference between the cognitive phenomena, the abstractions, and perceptual phenomena. So and that's where you get text and speech. But of course, speech is textual in its own way. So if we wasn't that distinction, it wasn't working nearly as well. So, the point where I'm trying to go with this is that the presentation for the. No, I don't remember where I say it that way. But the learning experience should not be, as it has been here, the presentation of some sort of content which should be presented and acquired, but rather it should be more like being immersed into an environment where there would be interaction with that environment causes you to recognize phenomena and respond. And that, I've put up a video game where I don't just mean a video game, but I say immersion into an environment. It's like Kuhn said, you know, learning how to do science and learning how to solve the problems at the end of the chapter. Immersion into an environment is immersion into the actual doing of whatever the profession would be. Learning physics by doing physics, for example, rather than studying physics. Learning forestry by going out into a forest rather than studying trees. So the emphasis should be on the development of the learning environment as a whole, rather than the content that was presented in this environment. That's the UN game, food force there. And I'm saying that I'm thinking because people have this tendency when they're designing games, and serious games, to identify some piece of learning that they want people to acquire and then try to insert it into the game. And I think that that's a very tricky thing to pull off. Because when a person interacts with the game, you can't predict what particular sort of content that they're going to pull out of that game. You look at a game like Food Force, and I might say that I think, well, this is pretty military. It's, you know, it's a UN relief operation. It's Food Force. And the lesson that the person might be getting is not, we should be talking to fighting children or whatever. It should be, it might be, we have to send in the military or something like that. So you can get very mixed messages when you try to put a message into the game. You need to be thinking of the environment as a whole and trying to create interactions or not even interactions, immersion of a person into that environment and allow them to see successful behavior in that environment model. Yeah. Way too much of that sounds. Okay. Where I'm trying to go with all of this eventually is that this leads to principles that inform the development of personal learning environments. And personal learning environments is a bit of a cliche that's been thrown around recently. The idea here is that understanding learning as being immersed into an environment as a totality rather than being fed certain types of content tells us things about how we should go about designing technologies that are intended to support personal learning. The overall model is as described here, where the teaching aspect is the model and the demonstration. The learning aspect is the practice and reflection. And then the arrows are supposed to represent the trajectory of the individual through that environment. And so when we get to the description of the personal learning environment, when we look at the sorts of things that are used to actually model actions or behaviors or practices in a professional community. And to demonstrate or to show, again, these practices, showing experts at work. The example I have like to use is the Chaos Manor, which is a column that was written by Jerry Pornell, who's known as a science fiction author. But he wrote a column in Byte magazine called Chaos Manor. What he would do is he would describe how he attempted to go about doing certain tasks on his computer. Today I'm going to install a new hardware driver. He wrote step by step, all the things that worked, all the things that didn't work, what he was thinking about, the hypothesis that he was trying out, all the different things that went right or wrong as he was trying to install this thing. And the idea here wasn't to teach people how to install a certain hardware driver. It was to show people how somebody thinks when you're working with something like a computer system. And then on the other side, the practice, the things that allow people to be in environments where they can practice things. And of course, the reflection. I'm not really happy with all of the elements of this description, so I'm skipping over parts of it. But the reflection on the practice and the discussion, the blogs, the wikis, the communicative aspects that allow you to think about what you're doing and communicate to other people as well as to actually practice. There was some discussion recently about Second Life at a conference where I was, and at that conference I was very critical of Second Life. And the reason why I was critical of Second Life wasn't because of the technology. I think the idea of an environment in which you can learn is a wonderful thing. But my criticism of Second Life was the way it was being used. The way it's being used predominantly by learning organizations is to simulate the learning organizations and create classrooms and meeting rooms to do exactly the same sort of thing that you're doing as you were in First Life. And it seemed to me that that wasn't taking advantage of the technology at all. That it was replicating the same model of learning as transfer of information rather than learning as being in an environment, same practice and experience. I think the Nintendo Wii is going to be a really good example of how learning can be much more than just acquiring content, because it's going to take people actually away from the front of the computer. They will, as you can see in the diagram, they'll be up, they'll be doing things, their experience will be, if you will, I don't want to say a whole body, because I don't know, but it will involve more of their senses. It will be much more immersive. And I think, and I've not requested nearly as well as I would have liked to today, I understand that, but I think that the challenge in the development of new learning technologies is going to be not how to get content from here to here. It's not going to be how to get people to remember things. It's really going to be how to project ourselves online. And by ourselves, I mean not just us as people who are in education, but how to get physicists to present themselves online, how to get geologists to present themselves online. Because I think that it's that sort of presentation, that sort of creation of an environment where there aren't things like geologists working, or in this case, air traffic controllers, where people can be in that environment and see people and interact with people who are actually doing that job. That's the sort of learning environment that we would want to be working for. And that's probably my comment, certainly my last slide. So I thank you very much for your patience. Thank you.